Welcome to Close Playing. I'm Tevis Thompson, and in this episode, I'll be talking with Ryan Kuhl about Panoramical. Ryan is an artist and writer, as well as a former editor at Killscreen, and his work often centers on embodiment, computational space, and the wide array of interactions possible between humans and computers. The game we discussed, Panoramical, has been described by its two creators, Fernando Ramayo and David Kanaga, as an album of interactive musical landscapes that morph to your touch, and an immersive musical adventure through space and time. In our conversation, Ryan and I discussed the challenge of describing a game like Panoramical, how our ideas about bodies and landscapes affected our experience, and the recurring question of just where we are exactly when we play the game. Welcome, Ryan. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start with usually I try to ask people kind of what it was like to play the game, and I think we have a real challenge with this game that I'd like us to talk about up front. I feel like with most games, games are really hard to describe, even though people try. And this game, you know, the usual kind of crutches of character and story and even like genre conventions and stuff are kind of stripped away so that, you know, you look at screenshots, you look at videos, it's just really hard to kind of get at what Panoramical is about and what it's like to play. It's almost, sometimes I feel like it's kind of pre-verbal or, you know, aggressively against language.
Absolutely.
So that being said, you know, like all games, you could say it's designed to be experienced. And I guess I'd just like to hear what that experience was for you.
It's refreshing though, isn't it? That it kind of strips all of that that stuff away and forces us to confront, you know, it would sound cliche to say that it forces us to confront ourselves, but it forces us to confront something. And you know, and what that something is, I think, is the sort of act of grappling with that and trying to delineate a kind of outline for it, I think is kind of like the substance of this game, I think. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for me, you know, as a kind of erstwhile critic, it was nerve-wracking. You know, my kind of analytical engine immediately started kicking into gear as I was playing it, you know, and it's kind of like what the great pleasure for me about games that David Kanaga has been involved in is that there is this constant, overwhelming kind of sense of movement and a kind of continuous slippage where, you know, my whatever assumptions that I come in with, first of all, like quickly, are washed away. Mm. And then my moment-to-moment understandings of the game and the kinds of details that I'm preoccupied with are constantly shifting. Mm. And I find that a very intoxicating kind of feeling because it's like, I'm trying to keep up with the game much more than I'm trying to kind of lay down a kind of critical framework for what's happening, which is a very refreshing, nice feeling to have and one that I think is really worthwhile. And
is it an anxious feeling? Is it pleasurable also? Is it what's the
well, you know, I have a baseline level of anxiety.
Me too.
so I don't know if but I don't know if I experience it as such when I'm playing these. It's for me, it's I feel a sense of transfixion, which is something that I'm always trying to chase in my own work and in my writing as well. Something where one thing leads to another, another and another, and there is a continuous feeling that it's almost like being being in a womb or something, or being something less cliche than that, you know. But
no, I know.
Yeah.
There's definitely something that kind of about this game that kind of roots you in the chair or the whatever you're sitting on and can transfix you in a way that many, you know, I search for that too. And many games really have a hard time achieving that. And it is, I asked about the anxiety or pleasure because it's a weird mix for me of this kind of tension in my chest, like something weighing upon it sometimes. And then finding a place that I get to, maybe when I start, you know, get to a point in each level where I've explored enough that I kind of know where I'm at, that then it begins to wash over me more of like a, almost a, I said this to you before, almost an ASMR like way. There's something when I let go of the control a little bit and get to a steady state that I like, that I can really kind of feel that pleasure more than when I'm searching at the beginning a little more.
I should say that this feeling of transfixion that I'm describing is really, in my mind, almost diametrically opposed to the kind of player feedback loops that people usually talk about when they talk about video games, like rule sets and win-lose conditions and sort of what it means to be an engaged, active player or what have you. For me, it you know, something like this completely elides all of those mechanics, those goals, those kind of metrics of engagement.
So it's not that kind of flow of, you know, ability meeting challenge.
Definitely not. No, not for me.
Right. No, me neither. It's hard even to think about the kind of challenge, or, you know, we'll get into this later perhaps, but about how this as a game, if you, how it fits into that framework or whatever, however people think about games. Okay, well, maybe we can talk about some of the more specific things about it, because if people see screenshots or they know that it's some sort of music art visualization type game, that it has a unique interface and that it doesn't have, you know, any of the clear goals or feedback loops that you just described that many games do. So what it does have instead is what?
Like a grid of parameters, right? And those are actually, it's funny because for a game that invites so many metaphors about immersion and escape and transcendence, it's striking to me that it isn't afraid to leave right in the open this kind of 3x3 grid of squares in the lower left corner, as if, like, you know, you're not just a player, but you're also an operator or a technician of some kind. And I think and each of those squares represents an XY set of audiovisual parameters that you affect. And I read that as being very much in line with VJ software and music software.
And you have experience with that, right? I don't.
Well,
really.
A little bit. I use VJ software in my work, and I'm mostly an analog, like vinyl DJ. But one of the things that I love about the game is that it allows you to use traditional MIDI music controllers to play the game. And I actually tried doing that with mine.
How was that?
I actually I liked it, but I actually really strongly preferred the mouse and keyboard, which I would love to get into with you. But what did you use to play the game?
Oh, so I 9 keys and a trackpad. So not even a mouse. So there was, I actually wondered about getting my mouse and seeing if that produced much of a different feel, because touching the trackpad, which, you know, is already itself a rectangle, and feeling that directly as I was, you know, holding the keys or combinations like chords and stuff, it was very, like, you never, like in most games, you're, you know, they hope that you forget the interface, or they, you know, that you're just, you know, lost or somehow merged in some way, that you're not paying attention to, oh yeah, that key does this. And here I never lost that and didn't really want to. Did you?
Oh, interesting. So were you constantly referencing, like, the parameter that you were changing?
Well, I don't know if I referenced it. I'd like to hear your kind of process with each level. If you, like, when I played it the first time, I was just kind of overwhelmed and not sure what I was doing. When I went back to it, I noticed that I had a tendency to go into each level, if we want to call it that. I had some habits, and so I would go in and kind of watch the, you know, the opening when there's nothing, you know, it's whatever its beginning state is. And it was kind of, I would sometimes kind of treat it like the, you know, creation of the world. I would take each key and you know, manipulate it just to see what it did, to kind of explore. Often I would find that some layers I didn't even like what they added, and so I would focus on maybe four or five instead of all nine. It depended on the level. And then I would kind of finally find, I was often trying to come to a state that I could rest a little bit, and that involved manipulating it to a point where I found that resting spot. But then before the end, when I, you know, how do you leave a resting spot? I would really mess with it, like, you know, multiple things, kind of, you know, multiple keys at a time, and just kind of playing in a more chaotic way that would finally exhaust itself and I would move on. What about you?
Interesting. Well, I started on this MIDI controller because I just kind of assumed that it would open up a different kind of feel for me than traditional game controllers have. And I've always been interested in kind of the resonance between modern day digital music controllers and game controllers. And so I have this controller called a MIDI Fighter Twister, which is funny because it actually, this product line began when these DJ guys realized they could take the buttons that they used on the Street Fighter arcade machines and apply them to music performance because they're really like well crafted buttons that are just really really fast.
Wow, fascinating.
And, yeah, and so actually this one that I have doesn't use those buttons, but it has a 4x4 grid of knobs that can each be mapped to a different parameter, whatever you want. And I use it for building work, but so I, you know, I thought it'd be perfect for this game because, you know, I could just map each parameter to a knob. Actually, I didn't have enough knobs for the game, which was awesome, but but the thing is, I didn't like it because it's almost like the one-to-one kind of mapping of the controller to the game parameters. And I don't want to say mechanics, I want to say parameters, really kind of reinforced this kind of itemized approach to exploration. And then as soon as I hooked up the, you know, WASD kind of keyboard mouse thing, which, you know, I know well from playing first-person shooters, the game immediately opened up to me. And it's funny because one thing is, you know, being able to press and hold a couple keys at a time and affecting multiple parameters at once, that really opened up a lot. And the mouse being this kind of weird, you know, the mouse is this weird confluence of kind of total freeform motion in a virtual space and total like anal retentive precision, right? It's basically your one finger pointer in this gigantic virtual space. So I have very little patience actually for, you know, like trying methodically trying like, you know, like one thing at a time, kind of. I just want to immediately be in the world, occupy the world, and kind of be flamingly around in it. And so for me, I just, I have always, playing this game, I've always just, it's always just like this fast, you know, like almost random, I'm not going to say instinctual, but like kind of almost like semi-conscious kind of clicking of different keys and a kind of just like searching around with my right hand on the mouse. And it's always this kind of act of, you know, I'm always like, I end up trying to tune the game into a specific emotional place that feels good to me. And then once that's very quickly exhausted or once I become impatient, I quickly tune to another, you know, kind of configuration. And
are you just kind of, you said you don't want to like go one by one or kind of, you know, move through it that way. Are you just kind of trying out different combinations in a, I don't know, some more, you said instinctual or something like that?
Yeah, I'm doing it really fast.
Okay.
I'm not even looking at what I actually. What's one thing that's frustrating is I kept accidentally starting video recording because I was like going so fast, and I don't really look at the grid. I basically am just kind of half focused on the visual landscape, and sometimes when I hit upon like an amazing configuration of color and shape, That's nice. Sometimes, a lot of times, it is led by sound. So if there is a particular motif that I really like, I really like these kind of medieval sounding or Baroque sounding motifs that, that he uses in a few levels. So I tend to like try to isolate those or bring them in. And I tend to not like the heavier like synth washes and ambient washes. So I tend to bring those down because I feel like I've heard so many of those in, in this kind of emotive indie games. So
It was amazing how the sound even worked in a way that I could understand a bit of what I was manipulating visually at times, but the way that the sound was able to, you know, I had in some way so much control, and yet it constantly, I don't know, it kept working in ways that I was like, why am I not breaking it? You know, like, why am I, how is it able to kind of keep up with me and still sound interesting? And of course, I preferred some sounds to others, but it just felt like it could fall apart. And yet it never, well, it rarely did to me. And I don't even know musically how he achieved that. But
yeah, well, my guess, if I can speculate on that, I mean, my guess is it's part, you know, maybe mostly compositional, just talent on his part. But also, I'm pretty sure he uses Ableton Live, which is a piece of music software that's known for allowing you to throw in all different kinds of sounds, and it will automatically time stretch and sync everything so that it loops very seamlessly. And then, so actually, it does remind me of the way that Ableton Live feels, which is this kind of musical sandbox kind of environment.
That makes sense. I didn't see how that even the basic timing kept working the way it did when I would be stretching it and everything.
But it's also his sensibility, I think, you know, and you know, I'm kind of like privileging Kanaga over his collaborator on this project, just because to me, like, the sounds are so, they so strongly inform this experience that it's hard to separate for me, like, the sensation of the game and the personality of the game from the particular approach to sound. But, you know, he tends to use these kinds of smears, like you're just kind of smearing sound everywhere. And you know, especially, I think it's probably most notable when you're coming in and out of a world, right? And you're transitioning back to the hub, and everything just kind of warps and slows down, like you're in a time warp. And so I think something like that is really, it really helps. I think there's a lot in there because it really sets this game as a music, kind of a music game, apart from practically every other music game I've played that purports to, you know, immerse you in a world of musical, you know, game playing joy. You know, like, I'm thinking of games like Luminous, or even a game like Rez, or a game like Chime, which I totally hated. These games, you know, I don't know if you've played a lot of these games.
Not many of them, no.
Well, it's like, you know, or Sound Shapes. Like, these are, you know, I appreciate the interest in music, that is expressed in these games. But I'm almost always disappointed by them because as soon as I start playing these games, like, it's very apparent that, you know, like, they have a certain worldview, which is that when you, as a player, press a button or make a motion in the game world, that corresponds to a game mechanic, which then corresponds to a certain sound. And it always breaks down, like, in a very itemizable way. It's very much like Lego. And for me, like, what that expresses is not anything inherent or embedded in the music or in, like, my act of playing it, but in the game designer's interest in connecting everything to his or her interest in music, you know. And I find it often quite patronizing, to be honest. See.
So is it just the too overdetermined, like the only goal is to sync the player in some sort of really direct and, you know, legible way with the music and what it's doing in the game, in a way that offers the player is not only not improvising, but they're not even producing that music in any substantive way, or, you know?
Yeah, well, I think there might be improvisation, and you know, and I think that I've had moments of pleasure in those games where the kinds of the audio-visual feedback that I've gotten from pressing a series of buttons has kind of accreted to this, you know, level where, like, things are happening musically in a coherent way faster than my human brain can handle it, but that the computer brain can.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's always very machine-like, and it tests my patience, and also, like, in a way that I think game, just a certain approaches to gameplay and game mechanics and game meaning also do. And so I haven't played this new VR, like, update of Res, but
I'm curious what you think of a new one called Thumper that I just started. That's, you can play VR or not. I don't have VR yet, but it's doing some of the things that you're talking about very fast and very, like, trying to, you know, get way beyond your conscious ability to react, but it's really keeping in line with a like a single line of I don't know. I haven't gotten far enough to know if it's interesting. I mean, I enjoy it so far. It's kind of hard, but I don't know what you think of it.
I haven't played it yet. I'm excited to play. It'll be an interesting test of what I just said.
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
I'm super psyched about it because it's Brian. I think it's Brian Gibson from the band Lightning Bolt, who are involved in this art collective Fort Thunder in Providence. Who, you know, I love everything they do. I think it's really interesting that they are that this guy from that collective has been building this what looks like a very conventional, if kind of edgy, video game structure. So I don't know, I can't say, but I'm looking forward to that. I mean, there's always like counterexample or something,
sure,
you know.
Sure.
But,
sure.
But the thing about these really kind of indeterminate sounds that Kanaga brings in, like, to me, like, basically with panoramical, it often you cannot even hear what change you're making, and it's definitely not always possible to isolate what you're doing and take apart, like, you know, sort out what's going on, and that's extremely valuable, I think.
And is that also a function of how fast you play? It sounds to me just like you play faster than me on some basic
could
way.
Be. Well, it could be, but it's also like, you know, but you also said that you sometimes you're intending to isolate certain sounds and shapes, right? And I'm doing that too. But the fact that that's actually a way that we can approach the game is says something about the game, I think, you know?
I'd like to go back a little to the way you were describing how you played it, because it sounds just so different than mine, and I'm really interested in that. And because as I described, like, I start out very slow and kind of, you know, testing the waters, sort of going in and feeling, you know, each I don't go in the same order every time, but I tend to do one or two keys at a time and just kind of play around until I find something, basically until I achieve a moment of beauty, both musically and visually, that I want to be in a little while. But after that, when I start to mess with it more aggressively or more just chaotically, it sounds a little closer to what you were describing. Did the levels, like, I guess, did the level determine some of your method or some of your more, like, more instinctual or more kind of haphazard approach, or did some levels
there was one level, I think it might be the fourth or fifth level, it's the one where suddenly it's not you're not sort of like kind of coasting over a landscape, looking into the horizon, but it's the one where it's almost like it's folded in on itself, and it looks like you're actually, like, the whole thing is like the back of someone's mouth or something. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
I think so. Yeah.
And that one, just because it's disorienting, like, that one makes me want to, you know, slow down a little bit and explore, like, just in what way I'm distorting, like, trying to make sense of this really distorted, paradoxical perspective. And that one's really pleasurable for that, but
Go ahead.
I actually don't know where I was going to go. So.
Well, that one that you're describing, that, and then the first and last, you know, which, you know, create like both a flat space and kind of a tunnel, and not really a landscape, with a lot of kind of kaleidoscopic type effects. Stand out differently than the majority of the others, like you said, are a little more landscape-ish. They seem to depend upon a sense of depth of field and just basic shapes that we identify with landscapes. But it raises, for me, the question from the moment I started this game of kind of where I am, and I don't mean like, you know, I mean, you know, in relationship to the space, like where in its space am I, who am I, not in a personal way, but like in a, since there's no obvious avatar as we're used to it, in this kind of where I'm locating myself, because there are times when it feels first person, you know, there are ways in which, whether it's going into a tunnel or hovering over a landscape, that given like the gaming vocabulary that I draw on, and outside of games, there's a sense in which I sometimes really felt the limits of the screen, because I, you know, in a way that I couldn't quite, you know, I can't look outside that, you know, there's not that kind of control, which we're used to with like a mouse, or, you know, just being able to turn your head or something like that, because that doesn't make, that's not what's going on here. I was often kind of just trying to feel out, you know, where I was or what was the space being created between us. And you've written about this, because I, you know, in especially in terms of like computational space, and I'm just curious where you felt panoramic, what, how it defined that space maybe differently than other games or similarly.
There are so many ways to get into, I think it really is this question of like, where are you? I think that really is the meat of the game, or of the work, or whatever you want to call it. I'm in total agreement that it just recently struck me that I assume it takes place from a first person perspective, just because, you know, you definitely don't have like a virtual body in the game. And so therefore, you know, you are looking through, I think you are still looking through the screen as if through a window into a space. But you don't have it. I don't have a sense that you definitely don't have an avatar, and you definitely are not an avatar either yourself. Right. You know what I mean? Like you're, and my relation to the game is not that I'm projecting myself into this second life, but that I'm trying to make sense of this shit that's happening on my computer screen, And when you were talking about seeing the limits of the screen, like that is something that I really want, I think, more of, because it's almost like it's very honest in that way. One of the screenshots I sent you, I took these screenshots. They look exactly like Jackson Pollock paintings, and it's a superficial resemblance, but I think it reminded me of like, you know, when I look at a painting, I want to see the limits of the canvas as well, and yet in spite of that, be drawn in somehow.
Right.
And I think that's where maybe this game is a bit of a provocation in terms of like immersive technology, in the sense that, okay, yeah, you can do a lot, you can max out, you know, what's on a screen, and you can still kind of show that, you know, I could play this on a phone, and I would be very aware of the size of that screen, but I think it wouldn't really fundamentally change the nature of that experience. Of course, it would be awesome in VR or something, but it's the fact that it kind of points to the real-world boundaries, and comes all the way back around and still kind of, like, you know, sucks you in somehow, and maybe spits you out.
I totally feel that same appreciation for those limits in a way that actually, if you have to think, to imagine it in VR, is a little hard. The transition, it would be very interesting, since I have very little VR experience, but those limits, where, you know, most games want you to forget that, and they want you, you know, that full field of play that you are just, you know, not even remembering those limits and constantly, not even, I wasn't butting up against them. Like I was just noticing them. I would just like look to the edge and, you know, feel it very strongly. Or I would feel some resistance in the game itself, in the way that you can control a lot of things, but the game, the level, it has a life of its own, especially like the first and last ones, which really have a beginning and end of sorts. And, you know, they take you on a ride, whether you're willing to go or not. Whereas the others, they seem a little, they could go on forever, and yet you can't, your control is certainly not absolute, but there's a shape and a design to each level that you, you have to work within, and you get to know it the more time you spend in it, and not master it, not overcome it. Maybe some people like can, you know, play this game like an instrument beautifully. I'm not close to that, but it doesn't even feel designed quite that way. And I really appreciate its ability to not draw me in spite of that, but to not make me forget that, to keep it foregrounded and to work within that in a very, I don't know what the word palpable, a way that is really gripping.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, though, because you are actually highly aware of the limitations of the parameters and the movement of the landscape,
right,
and
right.
The degree to which you can push it, right?
Right.
And I think, you know, it's easy to look at screenshots of the game and read about descriptions of the game and to assume that it's this kind of, I don't know, totalizing
right.
experience.
Right.
But actually,
right.
What I find valuable is that each one is you're always, each level, you're always very aware of the constraints that are
right.
put upon you.
Right.
And I think that really says something about our, you know, to me, it's, you know, I was earlier talking about like trying to tune to specific emotions with the mouse. And for me, I read this blog by this game designer who will not be named a few years ago, and he was specifically talking. He was a very kind of one of those very like ludological kind of dudes, and you know, he was talking about how, you know, as a game designer with a certain combination of mechanics and game iconography, he could tune his players to specific emotions, you know,
mm-hmm,
the ones that he wanted, presumably.
Right,
and,
right.
And, you know, I'm thinking about that in relation to this. And it's to me, this kind of like trying to find your feeling, but then always, trying to find your feeling, but it's always an emotion that actually isn't like a given known human emotion that
right,
we can kind
right,
of project,
right.
but one that actually emerges from.
Right, right. There's a negotiation between you and what you're, you know, the limits that you're feeling, and I think you use the word vibration, right, sometimes
mm-hmm.
in your work to describe some way of getting in tune, but also not, you're not just repeating or, you know, they're certainly not laying it down or you know, trying to like, you know, convey a message, which I hear you know, some people kind of clumsily when talking about any art talk about, well, what message are they conveying? And I'm like, are you serious? Like, do people still talk that way? Because that doesn't, like, even in mediums that are good at quote unquote messages, like the written word perhaps, I don't think of novels as, you know, containers for messages, or like, just, you know, there's skill in kind of, you know, not manipulating, but affecting your reader or audience in a certain way. But for it to just come down to this, you know, kind of weird puppet master who's, you know, playing you, that's, and, you know, which AAA games kind of excel at, I suppose. That's
yes.
So weirdly, like, off-putting to me.
Right, absolutely. And I think games in the conventional design sense do really readily lend themselves to a kind of message making, both on the part of the creator and on the part of the reader, or, you know, and the player, because you can assemble a mechanism that is intended to deliver something particular and is easily read as such. And then a critique of that, it's very easy to come in as a critic and to critique the game based on how much your experience may or may not stack up with
sure,
that
sure.
kind of intent. But that, all of that, you know, I think it's a zero-sum game, and I for sure it falls away with a game like this. In terms of finding this feeling, it's a little bit like chasing your own tail, or it's like, because the feeling keeps moving on,
yeah.
you know, it's like it keeps moving and shifting.
Yeah,
and
the game is constantly in it's weirdly both a static in the limits of the screen and in the, you know, both control you have and where you could possibly go, and constantly in motion. You can't, you just can't grab a hold of any moment very easily.
Right, and same with yourself, right?
Of course,
you
know, yeah.
So you find yourself constantly in motion.
Exactly.
I guess when you were talking, you wanted to, yeah. I mean, why I play the game fast? I think it's, for me, it's very much like you know, it's not that my body movements are being made in response to a set of rules per se, but that these parameters that I've been given through the game are somehow like moving my body, which is always trying to play catch up. And so it is a sense of like, in a phenomenological sense, I'm like reaching out to see what is the world, you know,
No, go ahead.
Well, I never find out totally. I can never fully understand it, which is great.
Right. And I think that relates in part to the way that the game, you know, in part it can, like we said, feel like first person in the sense of looking, and it's not, there's no avatar. And I think sometimes we just have those, we feel like we have those choices. Either you have an avatar or it's first person, when really, because you can, the way that you are changing things with the keys and your mouse, and you're, and that's all in there, it is a sense of a real dissolve between person and world. And there is and games play with this in ways all the time of you know, this, if I'm controlling these things that are the very, you know, foundation of the world on screen, and there's no clear me, it's outside me, the player, I feel like there's, you know, some sort of person that's not first, or if we call an avatar like third or second or something, but something that's that is no person, or it is, there is something that is because of that control we have, that limited control, but it is not. First person just doesn't work here exactly for me, and I think that I've frankly struggled with first person as the kind of default of whether it's shooters or a lot of like modern games that have moved beyond, you know, earlier Avatar games or something like that, that really frustrate me, because while a first person game is easy to describe if you're like telling the story of what you did, because it seems like it's like life or something like that, I'm constantly thinking of everything that is left out. First person creates a world situation and a basically a point of view and that just games can't keep up with. Like the lack of body, the lack of everything that really defines being a person in the world. First person, just at least a third person, or you know, having an avatar or something. There's no kind of, that relationship is very complex and interesting, but there's that sense of me being in it and usually shooting or something like that. I don't know. It just completely breaks down. I feel like the first person games, AI, game world, they can't, the gameplay conventions of genre can't keep up with what it means to be a first person in the world. And so here, the first person, which is already kind of a, it seems like a window, but it's really fraught. Here, it's, I don't know if it's acknowledging, but it definitely complicates that in a way that feels true. It feels familiar to what games, you know, how they have us relate to a world. So by having us manipulate it with these 9 keys and a mouse so, both so clearly and yet so, we can't keep up with it, like you said, I don't know. It made me come away in playing other games, kind of emptying out what first person kind of by default tends to mean to people. So,
for sure, I think that, you know, it's interesting thinking of this word person, because I don't know that there is a person to be, you know, discussed here, right? Like it's
right.
It's, I'm almost picturing like, you know, the classic kind of first person, like failure of immersion is like any kind of Bethesda game where, you know, you're playing a role, you have these things that you have in your pockets, and you're talking to people who have their problems that they want you to deal with. And, you know, invariably something breaks and then everything breaks like along with that. Right. And right. So, but then I'm thinking about like, well, a game like that, you know, in a to the Western mindset, it's like, it's positing that this object or this work or whatever it is, this system, this world is kind of standing here. It's almost like on a level with it. It's at eye level with you. And it's kind of right, like, right. It's kind of like looking back at you in this anthropological or not anthropocentric kind of way.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's like the game also wants to be a man, you know, or I'm saying man, like, you know.
No,
like,
I totally get you. There is a sense of whether the world, how the world is responding to you is, it's a way of thinking, yes, is it looking at me? I in a previous podcast, had talked to Patrick Klepek about Dark Souls and the way that it had done such a good job of at least the illusion of not looking at you, but that the more sequels there were, the more that it catered to you, the more you could feel the world turning towards you. You know, it was like a lover looking away, and now it's looking at you, and that is disastrous to me for the best parts of the Souls games. But it's typical for most games, and the way that they are not just designed for you, but they are staring you down eye level. That's good. That's right. I mean, that's the right word. I think it's something that doesn't even make much sense here.
Yeah. I'm thinking about this in relation to Panoramical, and I'm just, for some reason, picturing like this alien frog thing, like kind of sitting in the corner, just kind of looking at you askance.
Right.
You know, I think it's awesome that, okay, here we are, we're a person, I'm a person, I have a thing that I'm running this thing on. I have clear indicators of something that I can do as a person, and all kinds of shit is happening as I'm doing it, you know, and I could like draw a clear relation between what I'm doing and something that's changing, but you know, I can't really put together like what that something is putting together and giving back to me. But it's the whole time it continues to kind of stare back at me, but like at an angle, you know, angle, and this kind of landscape vision, it's a very conventional kind of like landscape in a lot of ways, right? It's got the horizon. It's got this like kind of like a Western, like a Cartesian kind of perspective. But it's the way it moves. There's something really strange and alien about it. And I think that it's interesting because in relation to landscape, the thing that when you brought up landscape earlier, the thing that always disappoints me with first person games where you're traversing this landscape is this, you know, idea that, okay, so it's a literal perspective. And so, you know, if you're supposed to be a body in this like kind of vacuum of a world, you're still supposed to have these kind of feet that imply footsteps, and you're never really quite aware of, you know, what a footstep really is, you know, in one of these games. And so for me, like the most disappointing first person game probably in that regard is Dear Esther. That's a game where it's like, okay, well, the composition and the writing aside, like that's a game where you spend like 2 hours like holding on the W key just to get the game to go, you know, just to get the story to go. And it's like this kind of disconnect between like, you know, like traveling across this this cliffside and just pressing the W key and like feeling the tension in your finger and just kind of wanting to just like let go or just like have it autopilot or something is like really strong, you know? But now, something go ahead.
No, I just that when people talk about Dear Esther or games that, you know, with a term like walking simulator comes up, whether praising or pejorative, like there's still a kind of unexamined even look at what walking entails and what it really feels like. And all that's missing that we just kind of gloss over. And it's not, part of it's the body. You know, I myself have a long, you know, relationship. We all have relationships to our body. Mine is somewhat antagonistic. And so, you know, that's it, that I can, maybe I want to gloss over that, but there is also something about the traversal that feeling step by step. I remember the game Grow Home a year ago where you clutched hand by hand, and it's kind of like a clumsy game intentionally, like a drunk robot like trying to climb on rocks. But there, it's a very simple effect of, you know, climbing, moving each, you know, I think you're holding down the back buttons and moving to, you know, hand over hand, and it creates, it's a very simple effect, but it's far more like rock climbing, or more like at least, you know, clinging to something than, you know, gliding over, you know, a beautiful landscape on a cliff or whatever. And so there's just something really, even in something simple like walking, that is that I don't imagine VR is quickly going to overcome, because the games don't keep up with that. I don't know that games are concerned with some of those things that I'm concerned with.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that we're talking about this in relation to Panoramical, because here's a game that doesn't especially seem concerned with the particularities of it. Well, maybe it is, but I'm wondering if you find it, if you read in that way too, that you're kind of gliding over kind of freely over this landscape in the way that you glide over, you know, the Dear Esther countryside or the whatever, the Skyrim hill or something.
Yes, I think that the game does absolutely glide, that the friction it produces is certainly not one that comes from embodiment or simulated embodiment. In fact, I think that the game is so intensely abstract and wanting to engage you with shape and color and form and sound in a way that it's when, you know, Dear Esther's and like Skyrim's, you know, quote unquote, like good graphics or their photorealistic, you know, aspirations really hurt them to me, because the other parts of the game can't keep up. It's the more realistic, when a game looks realistic, I, you know, part of me, not the gamer part who's so, you know, used to all of this, but the other part of me that's playing is like really asking some basic questions that can't be answered. The game can't keep up with its graphics. I mean, some of the most, you know, striking games, you know, recently, I mean, Uncharted 4 this year, its gameplay can't keep up with its graphics on a most basic level. It is so, the more, you know, either photorealistic or just, you know, AAA pretty it looks, then the more that its gameplay, you know, seems thin and obvious. And of course, we've been doing it for 10 years. So, you know, of course it looks like that. So Panoramical, it gestures towards none of that. And it wants to engage me in some other way than a body walking or doing things like that. And even its landscapes, as much as you're right, they look like landscapes. They're identifiable, like most of the levels are. The relationship I have is also more abstract, kind of in a sense of like, if you know, self and world are kind of constantly negotiating with each other. When I'm playing Panoramical, it feels like, for lack of a better word, like magic at times, or what I imagine magic feels like, is some sort of, you know, matter and will, some interaction with the world where my body, my will is affecting change, you know, without touching, you know, in a way that, you know, most magic does things that, so, you know, a typical magic of, let's say, creating fire. We do that all the time. There's just some steps involved, right? And they involve manipulating flint and things like this, and we can make fire also, not just will it into existence. So, you know, this cuts all of that out, and there is a sort of magical-like feeling, but it's one that, I don't know, is totally, to me, in keeping with the force and effect of the game. I guess I never felt, because the person was so not clearly first person, not clearly any person, and because the boundary of landscape or world and self was constantly in flux and just not never clear. I couldn't, like you said, grab it. I couldn't put my finger on it. Then it didn't feel, I didn't feel that absence or that, you know, thinness or shallowness of affect. Did you? I mean, did you feel that? Did that gliding over, or that what we're talking about with the body and in first person or in games? Did you feel that in Panoramical in a way?
No, like, no. The thing is, it's funny. It's like when you look at it, you know, if I were to kind of quickly glance over at someone playing the game on their screen, I might assume that this is a game where you're kind of coasting over this sea or this, uh-huh, this landscape, but it never really feels that way to me, partly because it's you're just kind of inching, you know, and it's very slow in that way. But also because you can't really read it in any kind of vectorial sense, you know. I'm not shooting anywhere. I'm not like right. I'm certainly not like trying to arrive somewhere, you know. And I think partly that might be a function of like this paradox between this infinite horizon and these kinds of moving like mountains and trees and things, but the way that they actually are kind of subtly looping or mm-hmm. constantly regenerating yeah, in a way yeah. that actually you're actually in a loop. You're contained right. in this thing. You're actually maybe right. it's kind of like the world definitely isn't flat. It's more like the world's more like a torus or something, yep, you know, yep. like, mm-hmm. And so it, in a way, in that way, I don't really read it as going over or through a landscape, but more like being among the landscape, you mm-hmm. know, like just kind of being there and being, mm-hmm. being present in a way. I mean, it mm-hmm. sounds present, but you know,
no, I know what you mean in hesitating with that word, but it also, a sense of being there that is not simply, you know, I'm here, here's my body, or here's, you know, I see the edges of my hands and my sword, and I'm walking around. Like, there's nothing like that kind of presence that is clearly separating you from the world. But actually, you know, I'm not sure even that our regular experience of landscape in outside of games is anything like the way games present them versus the way that Panoramical is presenting this. Because for me, you know, one of the most common experiences of landscape per se in life is driving to me. Mm-hmm. So the experience of a landscape of coming out of like a group of trees and suddenly there's something spread out before you. And that sense of landscape where I can feel my eyes going all the way to the edges, right, which is quite far away when I have some perspective. And there's a sense of, I think part of the reason people, you know, love coming into like a clearing where there's a, you know, something far away and there's a distance there is that you fill it up, right? You know, yeah. as opposed to being like in a elevator or something where, you know, you have nowhere to go. There is, if we think about the edges of our body and, you know, not less like, you know, skin and more like a, you know, phenomenological field that is extending to where our senses end and when our vision can really go far, but yet have something, you know, it's not like an oceanscape, which also has an endless feeling, but here there's a mountain or there's a hill or there's something blocking my vision. And I am filling up that space in a way that it's not only pleasurable, but it affects my whole sense of being in the world, if temporarily. And in a car, you know, it's weirdly fixed and there's a sense of foreground and background being really highly delineated. Some of my earliest experiences riding in a car was, you know, noticing how things move faster when they were closer. You know, it was like early parallax scrolling to me and watching the background and see and feeling out that distance and feeling out a sense of stasis in the background and something moving very fast. I also think the speed of driving affects, you know, how you experience that landscape, even though the mountain or whatever in the background is not moving. I was looking at one of your pieces, Death Driver, last week, and you know, you use a lot of loops there, and also, but what stays in the picture is this, you know, background that doesn't move very much at all, right? The yeah. horizon, and this foreground that is in constant motion and giving you and that I don't know, contrast or that, watching that became like a point of fascination for me, just to, like most driving, although here it was being, you know, looped to different ends. But, what I'm saying is landscape here, and that not just, you know, me and the world losing our boundaries, but the way we negotiate it anyway, and I just mean totally realistically in everyday life, feels, doesn't feel weird here. It feels concentrated and maybe kind of like sifted down to something more essential and abstract. But yet, I don't know. It doesn't feel like it is alien in ways. But I guess I just find it refreshing compared to how I negotiate most landscapes in other games. Yeah.
It's interesting that you're bringing up driving, because, you know, my relationship to driving, as you might have guessed, is really different from yours. In the sense that I had this intense anxiety about my body and my agency, you know, when I'm driving. Uh-huh. Just the sense of, like, I, you know, instinctively, you know, the way that, like, I think that psychoanalysts have talked about how when you see a cop, what you actually want to do first is pull their gun. And I think yeah. that similarly for driving, you know, for me, it's always like, I could. It just seems like it would be too. It's like I cannot shake this feeling that I could just turn the wheel a little and completely spiral somewhere else. Yeah. And when you're talking about to different ends, like for sure, that's. And I think the different ends part is something key here. I think that this thing about feeling up the landscape, seeing something in the distance. When I I've actually had two really recent experiences driving in Iceland and driving in California on Route 1. Where I was on a cliffside and I just everything opened up. I saw like the beach like in the distance rolling down like the cliff, and I was just like in the car like turning and just completely feeling swallowed up by this sublime feeling, and just like being totally scared out of my mind. Which is actually, I think, the opposite feeling that I get from, like these conventional kinds of video game landscape, like Skyrim types of video games, where I always feel like I'm much bigger than the world. I'm like looking into a pinhole camera or something,
Right.
So I'm not sure that I have that same feeling of being, of maybe, I don't know if you're describing a feeling of sublimity or of bigness or of a kind of like being embraced or absorbed into a landscape and panoramical, but I don't know. For me, actually, I think my metaphor is more like flying. Mm-hmm. And for me, like it weirdly, I was thinking about this in relation to No Man's Sky, and both games in relation to this really old PC game, Magic Carpet, where you're a kind of first person game where you're just flying around on this magic carpet and like and raising structures and casting magic spells on giant worms and stuff, but looking kind of this kind of vantage point that you have to kind of not this kind of defocused way of looking at shapes and looking at the features of the close and the distant landscape, which always seems kind of like a little bit below you. Kind of like you're able to see the landscape as a pattern, as a waveform, and certainly as an algorithm. And I think that's something that I like about both this game and of No Man's Sky, that they don't hide that this is an algorithmic generative structure. It's not supposed to be an actual ground. It just kind of signifies a ground. It's a representation of what it might be like to, having this musical, total audiovisual kind of aesthetic experience. Right. And No Man's Sky is just a representation of what it might be like to be traveling freely throughout this galaxy. I think what a lot of the criticisms of, I guess, that game in particular seem to kind of they don't really accept that the game can actually be trying to represent an infinite experience, but that it's actually not an infinite experience. It doesn't feel like one,
Right.
And I think it's kind of like, well, with both of these games, it's like, how can we really know what an infinite experience really is? This is just as close as we can get. And I think that for both of the games, maybe it's something in the way that they expose a lot of their limitations. That opens something of that up.
That's interesting, because I think that what you describe about flying or driving is actually more more truthful in some way than what I would describe, because like that sense that you could turn your wrist a little and die is something that I have managed to ignore or become so accustomed to that I. And I don't get me wrong, I've gotten distracted while looking at a landscape and had a wreck because of it. So I've had the experience of that. It wasn't serious, but it was kind of stupid. And actually, Highway 1 is not too far from me, and I know the terror of those cliffs. Sublime or not, like they are, those scare me in a way that when I think about landscapes spread out, there's usually not a cliff to my right or something. But that said, it's interesting that would still appeal in No Man's Sky, because I was also thinking of No Man's Sky a lot while playing this, and played them fairly close to each other, and found that I think you're right that No Man's Sky has... is pretty honest and straightforward about its limitations. in the game. And when you, I guess I'm just trying to feel out, because I have a less, I had less, not as good an experience with No Man's Sky over time, once those limits came into clearer focus. And maybe because it's trying to do some other things too, and so it mixes its message a little bit, or it gets, like, that difference between being on land and flying in No Man's Sky is a really interesting one, mostly because I feel like what you're describing of the seeing the algorithm laid out before you in landscape form or something like that, you feel the procedure and you can, you know, observe it from a distance. I feel like the game works much better from a distance. And even though, you know, you're kind of flying in a little bubble over the land and you can't hit it and all that, but it, you know, it preserves this sort of safe, limited view that, you know, but it's when you land and when you're in the landscape. And I think games can potentially do very with landscapes, really offer you something that is not easily replicable in terms of exploring a 3D space and getting into all the nooks and crannies and seeing something and going there and looking back and gaining perspectives. That, you know, that's, games are really good with that on a basic level, but No Man's Sky is not, because of its repetition, and it doesn't really reward you going more than, you know, 2 minutes in any direction in terms of creating a space that feels, well, maybe the, you know, it's highly stylized, and yet there is a enough realism to it that is nowhere or present in Panoramical, that kind of grounds it enough such that the uninterestingness of some of its procedural generation on a base level is kind of thwarted a little bit. Whereas Panoramical, granted, I don't spend as much time. I don't know how long you spent on like each level of Panoramical, but I'm not, you know, spending hours on one of its landscapes. And so the length of a song or the length of a long song compared to spending a few hours on a planet maybe is a part of that difference. But yeah, basically Panoramical's landscapes in the end spoke to me more than No Man's Sky.
Yeah, I mean, I should say, you know, I definitely haven't put in a ton of hours into No Man's Sky. And I can certainly see that, you know, the degree to which you're kind of frustrated by the landscape or exhausted by it is affected by the degree to which No Man's Sky is traditionally representational in the way that Panoramical isn't. But you know, I just say that in both of these games, like this feeling that you're describing about, like, not really, there not being any use of going, you know, 2 minutes, you know, in any direction in No Man's Sky, that is actually something that I enjoy about it, because it's, in spite of that, I found myself wandering. And
oh, yeah, yeah. I only know that because I've wandered a ton.
Oh, like I see.
I tried to walk around a planet and gave up after about 3 hours. But
oh man,
yeah.
Okay. And you found that you had nothing afterward.
Well, it's a game, like I said, the first few hours, the first few planets were really overwhelmingly exciting, in the way that, like, you know, when I've started games and kind of I'm breathlessly like, oh my god, the Minecraft world is real, in a way that other game worlds aren't real, they're not there, you know, and being excited by that. And something about the first few planets of No Man's Sky, before I kind of understood how it worked, I was just thrilled, frankly. It was only after a while, when I began to understand it more, that it could be exhausted in a way that I wonder, you know, we'll see with Panoramical. I've played it through all the levels a few times, and it feels, I don't want to say inexhaustible, but it feels like I could return to it in a way. Again, short sessions, not, you know, marathoned across galaxies, but but yeah.
Well, I wonder if actually Panoramical gets off the hook more easily, because it is much more in line with, you know, abstraction.
Uh-huh. I think so.
You know, and I wonder if that is, I mean, that actually is one complaint or criticism I have about it, which is that it kind of, well, it signifies these traditional landscapes, and that's fine. But then it can kind of play freely, you know, upon them. You can raise and lower and bring in and out different kinds of paradoxical structures. But there's a way that feels a little noncommittal. And I think the visual aspect of the game is maybe its weakest link. Like the interaction between the sound and the controls, like I don't know that I even necessarily need much of a visual component. But the way that it's much easier for me to kind of put together how each of these, you know, colors and shapes is meant to correspond to certain or evoke certain feelings, and it's much clearer, like, the degree to which I'm affecting them and what I, you know, what the discrete elements are when I'm playing the game. And I actually, I think that's, I don't know. I mean, I have nothing constructive to offer, in this other than to, just imagine that maybe one day we'll have a game that's kind of like this, but which visually or you know, haptically, like, feels much more like this kind of churning, like, indeterminate morass of, like, you know, indeterminate forms. And, you know, I don't know, but, like...
Yeah, that's interesting to try to imagine. Well, I'm thinking about the, you know, there's three extra levels that are on the game, yeah, right, that other people made. And I was struck by how much less I liked those than the original ones. And part of that, in other words, there were some interesting elements to them, but they were either too representational or too flat or too, just kind of almost cyber weird, what you'd expect of like a audio-visual manipulator. There was something about them that felt, I don't know, somehow tired to me compared to the original levels that the creators made.
I thought they were quite interesting in relation to the main game, but
why did you like them? I'm curious, since I really didn't respond much.
Well, I had very different... Well, first of all, what I found interesting about them was that I found them each distinct from one another.
True.
And
that's true.
And so I liked thinking about how panoramical, just the parameters of the panoramical, like, template or format, like, kind of are broad enough to encompass different points of view. I guess I just had really different experiences. The Bion world, the first one, Bion being the I think he's the composer, one of the composers at Q Games in Kyoto, and he's a pretty well-known techno artist. I'm a techno fan, and I one of my favorite PlayStation games is Pixel Junk Eden, which is a game that he soundtracked as well, which is very techno. But I found myself playing, that was much more in line with the kinds of music games that I was kind of lambasting. Where you it's very easy to tell, like, what you're bringing in and out.
Right. It felt much more discreet and familiar to me than the main game.
Just the shape, that kind of blob that's like pulsing in time, beat, and it's like, okay, it's like a heartbeat or whatever. It's like, I get it,
it's like an early MTV music video, like, that was done all in CGI.
Yeah. I still found it fun, I guess. Uh-huh. It was fun. It was capital F fun. I'll call it that. Whatever. I don't know. I like techno. Uh-huh. The second one, the Dose One piece, I hated completely. I don't know. I thought that the aesthetic was terrible of the cityscape, this kind of neon, cyberpunk looking kind of thing, and the sounds were fine, but they didn't differentiate themselves much from what Kanaga had done for the main game, so I didn't really have much of a feeling about it. But the last one, which I had read, was some kind of tribute to UK urban landscape. That one really struck me, and I actually found it the most affecting out of anything I played in the game, because it. Well, because the kind of variation in the effects was so much wider than
it was.
What,
it was wild.
The perspective was, it was actually pretty standard, kind of like, as if you're in a train, kind of like watching the buildings and things, like, kind of float by you from right to left. that kind of perspective was conventional. But what I liked about it was that it brought some particularity back into the game, like photographic kind of particularity. It looked like, you know, affected actual video footage.
Yeah.
And I found that to provide a kind of signifying backbone to all of the, you know, audiovisual kind of craziness that was actually really affecting.
I agree with you on the last one, because as I was saying that, I was thinking the first two with the heart type thing in the middle, and then the cityscape. There was something that was totally familiar and flat about them to me. But that last one, I took more screenshots of the last one than almost any other single level, because I was, like you said, because of the wide range, but because it felt like it was in the way that the main levels were, you know, going for something elemental. That one, it felt like I was like peeling back the code, or something about getting at something really basic underneath the different things you can manipulate. And I agree. I think that one is really suggestive and really different enough from the others, from the main ones, that I appreciated that you could use the basic tools and really go in a different direction. But I think part of what I'm interested in, kind of the differences in what we liked and how we responded, is also because the more I played it, the more it felt, as I, you know, would see things online about whether it was really a game. Even a friend of mine who really liked it just kind of dismissively was like, well, you know, it's not really a game, but it's awesome. I was like, okay, I don't tend to take up that conversation very often. I'm not very interested in it. But that didn't even strike me here, because, you know, maybe if I try to think about its goals or challenges, then I would, you know, be hard pressed. I don't think anybody doubts its level, you know, the interactivity, if they want to, you know, use that as some sort of defining thing. But I guess I found, especially in the way that I started to play it over time, of trying to get to these resting places before I, you know, completely fucked it up, I felt like that there was something, the more I played it, that it, you know, it really worked as a kind of exploration or interrogation of my own personal aesthetics. It was throwing itself back onto me, or throwing me back on myself, and in a way that I found more provocative than most, maybe because of some of the limits it was putting on, but also because of, like, for instance, its use of color. Like, I found visually some of the color things were some of the things I would manipulate the most. You know, like when I would look at the original 9, you know, keys and kind of play around with them, I would often, after a few minutes, shy away from some of the ones that just created like little organic growths or little, you know, little tendrils in the air, stuff like that. And I would spend a lot more time on the color and the things that seemed to affect it the most. And I found that its use of color, it foregrounded it in a way that for me was just really very simple, but also very like evocative, because I think that color is something that is so basic that we often just, you know, we can talk about the, you know, the grays and browns of modern shooters and stuff like that, and willing, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's not exactly what I'm thinking. I'm thinking more about how when I was playing Panoramical and I was trying to find what I responded to, what I liked, or what really repelled me, it was oft color had a, you know, a fundamental effect on all of that. And it reminded me of how much, you know, color is kind of one of the first things that as a child we recognize we have a favorite, right? Food maybe, and color, and you know, what's your favorite color becomes kind of like a defining, you know, a potentially defining thing for a child to recognize in themselves or ask of others, especially if it's different than like blue or green or something that's more, you know, common. But even if it is common, recognizing, I think I remember as a child just kind of realizing that, oh, someone else likes a different color than me, then that's really, they're really different than me. And that fundamental difference was just kind of like, for, you know, a child trying to overcome their childish solipsism, you know, was both interesting to me, but also something that kind of stayed with me, because over time, you know, favorite colors change. I know mine have. You know, I love purple all my life, but in the past 5 or 10 years, I've started to love orange in a way that I never did before. In the last year, I've started to like pink in a way that I, you know, never did before. And I'm, you know, about to be 40. So, you know, there's, you know, I've been around long enough to like have, you know, go through different feelings of color, but it's weird to me to like a color I didn't used to like on a basic level, or to really respond badly to a color. I had a long conversation with David Hellman, who I worked on a graphic novel with, and he was trying to make something turquoise, and I just realized how much I hated turquoise and all these variations on blue-green, and I couldn't really get it what, like, don't make it that color other than to say I can't stand that color, which doesn't, it's not really a conversation, but...
That's awesome. So in the conversation that ensued, did he kind of assert how much he liked turquoise?
And
did
he didn't like it as much as I hated it. And he, as the artist, I was the writer. So he, you know, he was kind of, it was his domain and I left it up to him ultimately. I would just, you know, give opinions, but, I definitely was having strong opinions that kind of shocked me. And he was, you know, great about kind of working with me and my strong opinions, but, sometimes you don't know it until, like, you know, I knew I didn't love that color, but when it was in my own potential work, and so here, you know, panoramical, like, when it would verge into the turquoise, I would be like, oh, get me out of here. And I would, like, look for these, you know, deep purples and pinks, and this is true in No Man's Sky. I found a planet, my second planet, had pink grass during the day and purple grass at night, and I could have just stayed there. It looked a lot like the colors were kind of like the Solaris planet. Like, it was just, I wanted to stay there. That's
awesome.
That's where I learned that some of the limitations of the game, because I stayed too long. But I don't know you don't seem as impressed by the kind of visuals of the game, but did the color matter to you like it does to me?
It didn't matter to me with the same level of, like, I don't know, profundity. But I should say that maybe as a visual artist, I did... You know, I guess I kind of took some of that for granted. Like the game met me and met my sensibility in a way that feels very familiar to me. Like, I immediately tuned myself, even like more, maybe even more unconsciously than with the sound. I immediately tuned myself to certain hues of pink, lavender, kind of, it's kind of like pale green, kind of, you know, and. The thing is, you know, and it felt very much like what it feels like when I'm in Photoshop, like kind of doing color corrections or whatever, you know, like working in Unity or something. But what I think actually is interesting about that, the fact that, you know, we can talk about even finding colors that we like, is that the game is so generous in terms of its palette.
Yeah, it really is.
It really is. I mean, it's not even like a rainbow, but it's very kaleidoscopic, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that is just puts it so much at odds with how many games have we seen where, you know, like, it's very apparent that they're going for a certain palette, which is then meant to express a certain kind of mood or something.
Right,
and I don't know. I think that it's hard for me to even get a read on, like, you know, I'm just wondering what the process of building this visual landscape was like, because sometimes it really feels like they just threw it all in there. You know, and I don't know. I don't know if I have much to say about it.
It's interesting to think about its generosity and its, you know, constraints. It's clear limits, because it does manage both in a way that is, I have no idea how to reconstruct, but also not even sure how much how that works on me, because there are games even that kind of would have a broad palette and really try to explore some of that or put it in your face. Like, I was playing a few months ago Abzu, which is like this. Do you know that game?
Sounds familiar, but no, I haven't.
So
played
it's. I think the art director of Journey made this, and it's very much like underwater Journey. I really disliked it because I found it aesthetically obnoxious. It was throwing colors in my face and just like overwhelming me with quote unquote beauty. And it was so much that it was monotonous to me. I didn't find Panoramical monotonous and in a way that I think it could have become that in different hands. And there was something about Abzu, besides its very familiar stale mechanics, and it wasn't really about anything, but it just aesthetically, which is supposed to be its high point, it was in my face in a way that, like, not just didn't leave any room for me, but was just screaming beauty at me.
There is just that basic overdetermination that's that's 99% of the time is there with game, right? I mean, even with Journey, like, I liked Journey, but I mean, the game's called fucking Journey, and it's like, you're like journeying through a desert. I mean, come on, you know? But,
and, it's like meaning the game.
Right, meaning, yeah. Feeling, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, at this point in the conversation, it's like I feel like I'm becoming, like, increasingly aware of this sensation that we're both kind of flailing around blindly together, right? Like, trying to get a grip on what this is, right? Like, with another game, like, this would be the point at which we'd kind of, like, go into little anecdotes about, like, interesting moments we had with the game or something, right?
Sure,
like, we'd be able to tell stories about, like, I was, like, you know, robbing this house, and, like, then the cat showed up and, tipped off the robot guard.
Right. That I was able to... It's this amazing emergent moment.
Right. But there is none of that particularity here. Yet, like, I think that when we were talking about some of the anxieties of language, or at least kind of like, even just as writers, I think we're just kind of like really like almost like fearing like confronting this thing in words, right?
Right.
To a degree, I think that that in a sense it's abstract in the sense that in the way that music is abstract, right? Like it's difficult for a lot of people to talk about music or to write about it, and yet music is very easy to be with. And music is also concrete. It's sound waves moving through air, and it's body movements and vibrations. So what I think is really, really valuable about Panoramical or something like it is that it may appear abstract, but in the end, I think that we come away with something that is undeniably like it is undeniably there, and I think that that really indicates the extent to which it is there is something actual about it. Like it is an event, it's a moment, and it is concrete.
It is.
I don't know. Like I think that the way that you were just talking about, like, you know, this question, like, is it a game? Is it not a game? And not wanting to get into that. And I don't want to get into that either. But maybe in a meta way, like, you know, to argue that, you know, the typical way we talk about games as sets of rules or at least given kind of components, these kind of determinate elements like the mechanics, the story, the character, the accepted themes, even.
Right.
I think that they actually are fundamentally, they're abstractions, they're propositions about what constitutes the game. And I think as critics, it's really easy for us to latch onto these propositions about what the game is about and also what the game is. Mm-hmm. And what bothers me is how easy it is to say, you know, these things are the game, and when we kind of implicitly sign on to that, it's almost like we're signing these clauses that put us into a binding agreement about what makes up the world.
Right.
And that's something that I think we need to kind of, as critics and as kind of like players with actual like human agency, we need to claw our way back out of.
Yeah, absolutely. Because those binding agreements, we don't even recognize often we're signing them, right? We just are, the language is out there where, you know, and you just accidentally do it.
Yeah. And, I think that, I think that something like this it's something that Panoramical has this effect of kind of scrambling all our circuits and throwing us back into, as you said, a pre-verbal kind of state.
Right.
A lot of people talk about, like, we need to find a critical language for talking about games, but I think we need a much cleaner slate than we might expect, you know?
No, I agree. When people talk about that, as if we could just have the words, everything would come into focus. And
right.
I, all the game thinking and conversation and writing I do, I want to get back at something like so basic, like so all those contracts that we've accidentally signed and all that language, all that, it's not even genre talk sometimes. It's just words that have accrued over time and through a lot of, you know, kind of thoughtless journalism and online discourse that you see this when people talk about they not only need a language, but old questions that people are still asking, like, oh, we already talked about that. And I'm like, you know what? If people are still talking about it, it sounds like you didn't come to an answer that satisfied. It sounds like, you know, that question's actually still up in the air. And even if a term like ludonarrative dissonance is overused, that some of the things it was pointing towards are things that are not over and done with. That's like an academic sort of hope of, you know, oh, we're going to make some sort of like progress in the humanities. And I'm just like, huh? Like, it didn't sound like progress to me. I think, you know, you sound just as confused as ever, but not acknowledging it. And there's no, you know, a game as challenging as Panoramical to even describe. I want to, you know, even if I fail, kind of embrace that challenge and not fall back on, you know, I don't know, either preset language or a feeling of, okay, well, I got it. You know, I kind of, you know, figured it out for now. I mean, we all move on. We can't stay forever on one game. But at the same time, it's openness, the fact that it doesn't allow itself very easily to be closed or kind of sealed off. And that is its strength. The challenge of describing it is, I think, something that is, not that I want to preserve that, because it's preserved anyway, but I want to appreciate it and kind of, I don't know, enjoy it even.
Yeah, I think that, you know, and I think that maybe the game, I don't know, maybe the game speaks for itself in a way. I don't know, maybe that's too easy. But I think that the thing about the problem I have with, you know, obviously internet discourse, but also academic discourse, is that it's so quick to formalize. Mm-hmm. And so much of its cultural capital and actual capital is contingent on how quickly and how convincingly it can formalize, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I kind of want to resist this idea that all games are texts that are just there to be inevitably read and consumed, mm-hmm. and especially to the extent that they're code, and then code is a language and has a syntax, and right. I don't know. It's too. It's a relation to a technological presence and an event that is so caught in a continual kind of slippage, in mm-hmm. that it keeps reinventing mm-hmm. itself, it keeps uh-huh. changing conditions. It's entirely contingent.
Right.
I just want to. I don't know. Like. I don't want to settle at Panoramical either. You know, like I feel like it's a good like kind of step, but to me it also like it, maybe the tenor of our conversation has made this out to be like an awesome counter to like every problem that we've ever had. But actually no, like I can also clearly I think see it as like a very primordial kind of aesthetic. Uh-huh. Proposal, which is that, you know, this kind of idea that a game can be about more than what it's mechanically saying it uh-huh. well than what it's saying it wants to do, and then how it mechanically goes about achieving that. Mm-hmm. Like I just think mm-hmm. it can be about more. So and you know and but then I don't know, at the end of the day it's like, okay, well it's basically it's like an album, it's a series of compositions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have like how many albums exist in the world now, you know, like, and it's like that, this is like a starting point, you know?
Thanks a lot for talking to me, Ryan. I really enjoyed our conversation.
No problem. It was my pleasure.